session number 10044, reel 6.
Mr. Powell, reel 6.
Well, I worked it out that Heliopolis of those three airfields would suit me best, as there was a good tram connection for central Cairo. So at Heliopolis it was that we landed. I tell this rather trivial, these rather trivial anecdotes, because I think they typified the gauche and amateurish atmosphere which accompanied the Americans and was very evident in Allied Force Headquarters, North Africa. I recollect two other instances which illustrate that, both of which occurred when my section was working in Allied Force Algiers. I happened to be accommodated in quarters which were shared by American officers. Indeed, my room, the room in which I slept, was shared by two other American officers who were considerably incommoded by my habit of getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning. They were greatly struck by this, that I should be going off to work at headquarters at 4 o'clock in the morning, and offered the comment that they weren't taking the war seriously enough as yet, but clearly we were taking it mighty seriously. The other incident was when Rommel succeeded by, I think it was the Cassassine Gap in the south of Tunisia, by a side sweep, capturing 50 Sherman tanks. And the British at Allied Force Headquarters were absolutely devastated by this information, to the astonishment of their American colleagues, who said to them, "Hell, there's lots more where those came from." And then one realized how for what seemed ages we had been fighting the war on a shoestring, and that we knew perfectly well how devastating Rommel could be with any clapped-out British equipment that came into his possession, that he'd soon have it running and facing the other way. But it was typical of the difference in approach, the sense which the United, which the Americans brought with them, of unlimited resources and a take-it-or-leave-it attitude which accompanied the possession of unlimited resources and the assurance of winning anyhow, someday, somehow. Well, in Algiers, the targeting process was very similar to what it had been in Cairo, but more intensive, since, of course, the sea traverse was relatively short compared with that related to Cyrenaica, and also because, obviously, the Allied forces were going for a kill and were not so much concerned with survival as we had been in North Africa for the previous year or year and a half. But I remember with similar admiration working with the Royal Navy under A.B. Cunningham. He certainly had a terrific influence for morale upon his headquarters staff. It's different. It was different. I shouldn't use the present tense. But I was always struck how different it was to work with the Royal Navy. You had to, first of all, to work very hard in order to win their confidence and in order to convey that there might be some information which a brown job had that was of relevance to the operations of the Royal Navy. But when one broke through this initial screen, one couldn't but admire the both the efficiency and the dedication with which they worked. And I came greatly to enjoy, even at second hand, the feeding of material to Admiral Cunningham. When the end of a campaign came, with the ineffectual attempt to continue servicing the remaining German forces in Cap Bon with landing craft, F-boats, I recalled that my unit was only on detachment from Middle East. since my eyes were then by then set on getting to the Eastern theatre of war, I announced that that was the end of my work in Allied Force Headquarters, that I was going back to my proper station, which was Middle East, and I would be taking back with me what remained of a unit which could no longer utilize the expertise that had been built up over 12 or 18 months in dealing with seaborne communications. Seaborne communications and ultramaterial relating to those communications had provided a unique intelligence effort in Middle East and in Allied Forces Headquarters North Africa. But that would be at an end as soon as the war became continental, and as soon, therefore, as the main lines of supply were inevitably landlines of supply, which didn't leave the same traces or form the basis for comparable calculations in the high-grade cipher system which the enemy used. Unfortunately, Director of Military Intelligence, Kenneth, later Sir Kenneth Strong, had got used to the degree of prestige which he had with his fellow intelligence officers of both nations, deriving from the operations of the inter-service staff, and he was extremely reluctant to accept that there was an end to that phase of the war at any rate. And I remember a blazing row that I had with him, almost pushed to the point of military insubordination. So impatient was I with the failure to appreciate the unique nature of the intelligence material which had hitherto been handled, and the inapplicability of those methods to the handling of the intelligence material which would thereafter illuminate and govern the land battle in Sicily and in the Italian peninsula. Anyhow, I fought my way out. It being one of the characteristics of a British Army itinerate in war, that if you're sufficiently determined, you can go anywhere and do anything that you want to do. Indeed, I think probably this has been a characteristic of a British regular army over a much longer period, and accounts for the achievements in the British Army, historically, of the odd man out, who could always get himself on a detachment, who could always get himself on a job in which his particular talents and his particular insights could be used. One of the characteristics, and I'm reverting, I know, to a theme which I've already spoken about, one of the characteristics which was most marked to me about the British Army in World War II was its readiness to use talent wherever it could find it, and its freedom from snobbishness when confronted with the idiosyncratic, or what the Americans call the oddball. The British Army worked with the material which it had, however curious, however unassimilable. Anyhow, I won my passage back. My passage back was to be recorded in an article contributed by my companion to Blackwood's magazine in 1947 under the title Teaching the Professor. I need not therefore enter into the details, except to say that the basic operation was to draw a 30-ton lorry from Ordnance, Algiers, for delivery to Ordnance, Abbasia, Cairo. The delivery to be overland, and that was the first direct overland crossing from North Africa to Middle East, which took place after the Germans surrendered in Cap Bon. And my army assistant, one major at that time, M.F. Strawn, who had been my intelligence officer in my later days with 9th Armoured Division in Northamptonshire, and had joined me to assist me in the work of the section in Allied Force Headquarters, was not only to be my companion on the journey, but was also to be my instructor on the driving of a 30 hundredweight lorry. it might be worth mentioning how Major Strawn came to be on my staff, because he had been a valued member of the staff of 9th Armoured Division after I left it. There is, however, a habit in the American Army whereby all orders are signed, not as in the British Army by a staff officer of the relevant formation, but by the commander. My second request, therefore, forward in my behalf for the posting of Major Strawn to Allied Force Headquarters was signed Eisenhower, and created immense consternation when it arrived at Headquarters 9th Armoured Division, who decided they, of course, couldn't possibly withstand General Eisenhower if it was General Eisenhower who really wanted Major Strawn in Algiers. I have to confess that there was another element of irregularity about this particular journey. I had accumulated in Algiers a great deal of basic material from Uncle Henry. Indeed, I wouldn't swear my Bible oath that I hadn't taken a certain amount of Uncle Henry with me via the desert route between the Middle East and North Africa when I transferred the section. Anyhow, it was part of a section, and it was therefore loaded onto the lorry, which was given the name of Pinafore, the Gilbert and Sullivan name of Pinafore, in a large locked filing cabinet, which received, before the end of the journey, the sobriquet of What's-His-Name, because What's-His-Name, in the adventures of a journey, was apt to have a personality of his own and move about from one part of the lorry to another, rather like the rogue gun moves about in the ship in Victor Hugo's 1893. The journey, which I will, since the details are for the most part on record elsewhere, I won't waste time with the journey, except to say that I passed out as a driver of a 30-ton lorry by taking the lorry into central Cairo, to the admiration of my companion, and parking it in the Gezira Club. It had been a fantastic journey, 200 miles a day, 16 days, from Algiers to Cairo, backwards in time, through the memories of a North African campaign, passing El Agheila, through Benghazi, past Tobruk, through Mersa Matruh, past El Alamein. It was a weird journey backwards through time. But arrived at General Headquarters Cairo, the problem was how to get to the Far East. My brother officer, Major Strawn, not sharing the same predisposition for the Far East, got himself a staff course at Haifa, and subsequently had a distinguished career with the army in the advance up the Italian peninsula. But I was anything but anxious to continue to thrash straw in the Middle East, which was now turning its attention increasingly to the Balkans and to an operation against the Italians in the Dodecanese. I wanted to know none of these things, and pestered everyone who could help me for means of getting a transfer eastwards.
What were your reasons for rejecting the Eastern Mediterranean for the Far East?
I should probably, at this stage, recapitulate to the extent of referring to what I called my Christmas appreciations. For each year, 1940, 41, 42, I had written an appreciation as a Christmas present for my senior officers. The one which I wrote in 1940 was not very well received. The burden of that appreciation was that the war could only be won if Russia was on the side of the United Kingdom, only with the immense resources and strength of the Soviet Union could victory be conceivable. in a war which would have to be fought out on the continent with masses of massed armies. I understand that tactful inquiries were made following the submission of that appreciation to ascertain whether I had connections with the Communist Party or other undesirable affiliations. But in the end, the conclusion was reached that this must be another of the idiosyncrasies of this rather extraordinary officer. However, it turned out, 1941 appreciation, I don't distinctly remember. The 1942 appreciation, however, was of great importance. In that appreciation, I argued that the war could not now be lost in the West, that with the Germans withdrawing from Stalingrad, with the Middle East saved, with the Mediterranean in Allied hands, sooner or later, the war, one way or the other, would be won in the West, and that the most effective way of winning the war, indeed the title of this, the rather irritant title of this appreciation, was Peace with Germany Now, a rather remarkable title, perhaps, for a Christmas appreciation written in December 1942 by a staff officer on the strength of GHQ Middle East. The most effective way of winning the war in the West would be to make peace with a Germany whose rulers had clearly failed in their intentions and who could therefore be left to be dealt with by their own people, who would deal with them much more efficaciously than their victorious enemies could do, and much more lastingly, with the result of a settlement in Europe more durable than that which had been imposed in 1919. So in the terms of the First World War, I suppose I would have been classed as a supporter of the Marquis of Lansdowne. But there was the other side to my thesis, and the other side was that the important war for the British Empire was now the war in the Far East, and that it was essential for the survival of the empire, something which I then still regarded as in the realm of practical politics, that Britain and not the United States should reoccupy Burma and Malaya, and that if not the dominant partner in defeating Japan, we should at any rate be seen to be a major partner alongside the United States. For Britain, therefore, it seemed to me that the important, that the vital theatre of war now lay in the Far East, and I wanted to get into it. I wanted, as I naughtily put it, to get to Singapore before the Americans. Of course, there was quite a row amongst the recipients of my appreciation, but not for the first time. I was bailed out by the Royal Navy, who said, yes, from our point of view, the future peacetime threat obviously is a threat from the United States. That is the power in the world that we shall have to reckon with in the peacetime scene. And that will be a power which will threaten the naval position of the United Kingdom. So I was imbued, and had for some time past been imbued, with the desire to get into the operations which would culminate in the recovery of Malaya and be part of a run-up to the defeat of Japan. I remember, said he rather defiantly, because it is this kind of event in which memory sometimes plays us false, hearing that General Wingate was at GHQ Cairo, catching him as he was about to get the plane and insisting on travelling to the airport with him in his taxi and getting him to promise to take me with him on his second, this was between the first and the second of the Chindit expeditions. Why it was that that didn't come off, I don't know. It may be, of course, that before he came back east, I had already hitched a lift, so to speak, with General Cawthorne, the Director of Military Intelligence India, who recruited me for the establishment of a joint intelligence committee, India and Southeast Asia, which would work to the Joint Operations Committee, India and Southeast Asia, and form the basis of the SEAC intelligence and Southeast Asia Command planning against the date when that would be separated and have its own separate existence from India Command. So it was in the light of the work which I'd done in the inter-service targeting section that I was recruited for India Command to be Secretary of the Joint Intelligence Committee, India and Southeast Asia. And although I would have gone down to Major in order to get East, I was posted East from Cairo in my then rank of Lieutenant Colonel. I remember the despair of the officer in charge of MIX, that is Military Intelligence Posting Section, when confronted with myself and Major Strawn. He remarked once, so we were told, "All my time I spend dealing with officers who want to get promoted. I've got two cussed officers here who wanted to get demoted in order to get themselves taken where they want to go." I think probably Major Strawn didn't drop rank, but I remember intimating that whatever rank I had to drop in order to get into the Far East, I was quite happy to do so. Indeed, I suppose psychologically in my own personal life, what the war meant to me in terms of self-confidence was that I had three times the experience of starting fresh, starting as a private in the army, starting back again after my experience in armoured formations and at the staff college, starting back again at the bottom in the Middle East, and starting in a completely new theatre of war in India and the Far East. There's a certain self-confidence which one gains by being able to tear it up at a stage in one's life and start all over again and still get through. Anyhow, in August 1943, with great relief and by flying boat once again, I found myself heading eastwards from Cairo to Delhi. I need only record my first night in Delhi. For the train, it was a train from Udaipur, presumably, from the landing point of the flying boat, got into Delhi at a late hour when headquarters was closed. And I had no instructions and nowhere to go. And I remember sleeping in my valise on the station platform at Delhi. I date from that moment, probably romantically, my love affair with India, the love affair which was to keep me in India and in the end to frustrate my desire to be part of the reconquest operation under Lord Mountbatten. But I'll come to that presently. I found myself working directly to General Cawthorne in India Command and as his representative on the Joint Intelligence Committee. A very strong personal rapport sprang up between us. He was a Punjabi and an Australian dedicated to the Indian Army and its ways and dedicated to India. And I suppose that his sympathy and his encouragement led me to help me to devote myself in parallel with the work that I was doing as Secretary of the Joint Intelligence Committee to both to learning Urdu and to accumulating as deep a knowledge as I could of the earlier and more recent history of India. The initial love at first sight continuously deepened as long as I was in India. And when I came home, finally, in February 1946, it was only because I was then satisfied that there was no future for a person like myself in the post-war army in India. But I remember saying at the time that had the Indian army been going on, I would have stayed in India and gladly left my bones there. But I'm jumping ahead. I'm jumping ahead what seems a huge period of time, but can really be no more than some 6 months. The 6 months, the last 3 or 4 months of 43, and the first 2 months of 44. It was at the end of that 6 months that the Southeast Asia Command set up its headquarters at Kandy, and that the work which I had been doing for SEAC as opposed to Indian work would be transferred from India to the Southeast Asia Command. I should add, incidentally, that since I was on the ultra list, I also maintained in India. And India went on with this for several months after the separation of the Southeast Asia Command. I maintained a shadow of the study of seaborne movements by the Japanese, a shadow of that which I had practiced upon German seaborne movements in the Mediterranean. One was, of course, using American decodes. What I believe, the American code name, I believe, was purple. But at any rate, there was a mass of ultra-type material concerned with Japanese air and sea movements. And those I processed in the manner that I've been used to processing ultra-material in the Mediterranean theater. It must have included relatively more information relating to movements of the Japanese Air Force, because I remember it must have been around December 1943, a great row with Lord Mountbatten. I used as Secretary of the Joint Intelligence Committee to do weekly presentations for the higher staff of the Southeast Asia Command. And at this time, operations affecting the Andaman Islands were in consideration. And I did make certain observations on the potential Japanese air effort over the Andaman Islands, which Lord Mountbatten misunderstood as being, as involving an appreciation of British capability, which would naturally be an invasion of foreign territory by an intelligence officer. When the break came, when India was ready to give birth in intelligence terms, in operational intelligence terms, to the Southeast Asia Command, I received this